Hey everyone, welcome to Club and Country Today, the daily World Cup reaction show here at Major League Soccer. David Goss, Bobby Warshaw with you, Matt Doyle jumping in, Andrew Wiebe as well, to react to all things USA Netherlands as the United States exits the 2022 World Cup after a 3-1 loss at the hands of the Orange. A big game. Obviously, we expect to see the numbers over the next few days. It will probably be the most highly watched U.S. men's national team game in history here on this Saturday, and the U.S. heading out in the knockout stages here on this Saturday. We're going to let Andrew Wiebe breathe a little bit. We've got Doyle with us as well. But, Bobby, let's just open it up to start. What's your initial thoughts? How are you feeling? How did you experience all of this?
It was fun. I don't know where else to start except to say that it was fun. And we've learned as U.S. men's national team fans, all sports fans really understand that you can't take for granted when your team makes you feel proud, when your team makes you feel alive. And I'm very appreciative that this team gave us that over the last four games and 10 days, because every part of it, every half was fun in some way, right? Sometimes we were screaming, sometimes we were laughing, but at the core of it, as sports fans, it was a really enjoyable four games, including this one. And I'm appreciative that the team gave us this experience over the tournament.
I think that's the right takeaway early on, is that this is a team that you can be proud of. This is a team that is enjoyable to root for at a time when the sport on the men's side in the U.S. needed something to rally around and needed something to push it forward. Obviously, the women have done it heavily, but for this men's team, you needed faces that people would know and like for reasons on and off the field. And I think that's what you got over the last few weeks, was the way they played on the field set the stage to show their personalities off the field. And you have now a team and stars that people can root for and people can rally around and can sort of be the face of this and push it forward. And you got to be there to enjoy it, right? And that was the first step, and they got there. And I think I agree with you in that the last 2 weeks have been really enjoyable. And I think people will walk away again after the Landon Donovan Algeria goal celebration saying, when is the next U.S. men's game? I can't wait to watch. I want to tune in. Where's Tyler Adams playing? Who are these people? I think that was an accomplishment. It also personally, like you said, was an enjoyment. Like, I want to watch this team more, and I'm back in. And I don't know that that was the case over the last few years. And I think that was probably the biggest part of this tournament.
And I like your point about the individuals, because we've had enjoyable U.S. men's national teams in the past, but it feels like this group of humans is more, it's easier to latch onto them. It's easier to have the experience with them, to enjoy it with them. And I thought we've seen that really come out in this tournament, that we knew that they had personalities. We knew that they liked each other, that they were fun. But it does feel like over the four games, it wasn't just about the soccer. It wasn't just about the 90 minutes, but actually the people on the field and the humans were people that fans and everyone across the country could connect with, which I'm not sure we've had in the past like we have right now.
Yeah, Tyler Adams became a star, right? Like the way he conducted himself, especially during that Iran press conference. And then, of course, the way he played, even though, you know, we'll get into it, but that first goal of his, or goal of the Netherlands, that does fall on him. But he became a star. He is like something close to a household name. Pulisic got his moment. You know, Weston McKennie, I think, has some standout moments. Yunus Musa, especially with that smile of his. I think there was a connection formed. And I'll just echo everything Bobby said. Like, yeah, we lost today. I loved the way the U.S. played, man. Like, even in a loss, it feels really close to how I felt 20 years ago in that loss to Germany in the quarterfinals, because the U.S., like, they were clearly the better team on that day in that game, and it was just the Germans in the knockout round. I'm not going to say that it was that level today. The U.S. were not the clearly better team. I think, you know, Louis van Gaal put together a masterclass of a plan, and that the Dutch executed it. But to see the U.S. play with zero fear, to not go into a shell, to keep pushing and to do so in smart and effective ways, even after you're down 2-0 because of a couple of young player mistakes, it was invigorating. And that's how I feel after this whole thing. After the four games that we saw from this young team, like all of it was so dope. Like it was great to watch a team with an identity and a point of view and these young, talented kids executing upon it together against the best teams in the world. Like that's what I want. And we hadn't had it in so long. And it felt really good to watch it again.
Bobby, yeah, you said something similar to me before the show.
Yeah, Matt, I want to add to that because I think one thing that's important to do in these moments is contextualize the situation, right? What does this mean? How should we feel? What should we take away from it? And the way I think about it is in two parts. I'm not sure that the results are, I mean, it's always true that you shouldn't focus on the results. I think the results in making to the second round are table stakes, right? I know we celebrated after the last game. I know it was fun. The most meaningful part is that it gave us 90 minutes to enjoy it again. But for the U.S. men's national team, making the knockout stage is the expectation, right? That is the table stakes of this program. They've done it 4 out of the last 6. They've been doing it since 1994. It's been happening for decades, right? But to what you said, Doyle, it's the way the games looked. It's the shape of the game. It's the fact that when you watch the U.S. men's national team against the Netherlands and against England, you weren't sure who the world powerhouse was. That when you watch the team against Wales and Iran, for the most part, it was very clear that the U.S. was the protagonist and that the U.S. was the better team on the day, which we could not say in those previous runs to the knockout rounds. And the amount of control this team has, the amount of bravery, the ability to play in different ways, the ability to take it to anybody in the world, that is what's different. So it's not about the results, which are more about an extra 90 minutes to have fun, but the shape of the game and the way they took place, that's the exciting part. That's the reason to be optimistic, because that's what suggests that there's more of it to come.
Isn't it also that it's young players doing that, and that hasn't been the case for the U.S. in previous iterations? Sure, you've had the Landon Donovans and DeMarcus Beasleys of the world. You've had the guys that have broken in that way, but it's the fact that on its almost entirety, outside of old man Tim Ream that got called in at the last minute, maybe you could say Walker Zimmerman, who's in his prime, but you know, you have Robinson, you have Richards that would have been there in their stead had they been available, that this is a young team without the benefit of World Cup experience that are the ones doing it, and it will be a younger generation still that push them and get to the levels that allow them to be comfortable in these moments in 2026 against world-class players. Like, to me, I agree with you guys on the performances, everything else, like in the immediacy, yes. But as far as looking at the future and thinking about the path of U.S. soccer, like, these guys aren't the only ones who have done it, but they have created that path. They've created the path for the 15-year-old that's watching this and is now in the backyard banging a ball Bobby Warshaw style against a garage. They've created a path for hundreds, if not thousands, of players that for previous generations, yeah, were they playing the game? Were they there? Did they have the pathway? Did they have the examples? Did they have the role models? Did they have the coaches, the facilities, everything they need to be more players that can impact the World Cup, that can play at Chelsea, at Juventus, that don't look out of place in the Premier League? Like, to go to what you always say, Dave, like, this is just the beginning. That's the exciting part for me, to see these guys do it without the benefit of having the dry run in 2018 for some of them, to see them do it without having 8, 9, 10, 12, maybe even 15 guys that are just like veteran stalwarts that you can't boot out of the team. Like, they did it on their own. They made this story on their own, and now that's the story that continues. Now that's what these young kids can pick up, and there's going to be a freaking army of them. And that's what's so exciting for me. This feels like just the beginning of like what I hope would be a golden era, or the beginning of one for the U.S. That looks different than any of the ones in the past.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's the point I was going to make as well. And I think that in what you're saying, Bobby, of, well, the performance style was there, the results were standard, well, then that was an unknown. We didn't know that the U.S. trying to reset and bring the youngest squad to the World Cup, and let's be real, build towards 2026, would be able to get the results at this World Cup. The expectation, again, is where it is, but it wasn't the last 5 years. They didn't even get to the last World Cup. So while the U.S., I think you could say in 1994, 02, reset the standard, which was we get to the round of 16, that hadn't been true over the last 5 years. So you had to at least get back there. And as Wiebe says, now I think it gets even stronger and stronger going forward, because even when you look at this game, you know, everyone's talking to me about lack of depth. Yeah, well, you could barely get one roster together, right? The U.S. is building its first team right now. So there's no depth behind that because it didn't exist yet. And now over the next 4 years, you keep adding and adding and adding to that, and you hope it continues to get better and better. Doyle, you've sort of said something similar to what Bobby said about the performance, the style at this World Cup being unique. And I know we've texted about it as well, of the feeling you get watching this team versus what we've gotten basically ever else for the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that would – the moments that come closest would be the 2002 run, though this run was much more about game control, and that team was more about driving the game to go out of control in its way, and sort of anarchic elan with which they played in those knockout rounds. So it was very different. And then 2009, which was in the Confederations Cup against Spain and Brazil. And that was, again, more of the 2002 thing. And like both those teams deserved to go as far as they went. Both those teams were legitimately great teams. And I think you could maybe make the argument that if you dropped those teams and this team head to head, right, those teams would win because they just have more final third quality. They have more experience, better on set pieces, stuff like that. But what feels different is that it feels like what has been built over the past few years is a foundation towards a higher level of playing the game, a foundation of upon which you can exert control over the game against the likes of the Dutch and the English. And that is not something that we ever really had before, even when we had superior talent in some spots. And you see it in how the Dutch set up. I mean, they respected us enough correctly to roll out a premeditated regressive game plan. We've never seen a big team actually do that in the World Cup. Now, the Germans 20 years ago, they did play regressive soccer, but it wasn't because they respected us from the kick. It was because they got 3 minutes into the game and said, holy hell, these guys are running around like their hair's on fire. This was different. This was before the game tactically saying, if we, you know, bring our lines upfield and we treat them like we treat, you know, most other teams, they're going to have the ball and they're going to pull us apart. And I think that is a credit to this midfield. I think it's a credit to the center backs, particularly Tim Ream with his distribution. Mm-hmm. And it's a credit to Greg Berhalter. And the how far we go in the next 4 years, part of it is obviously going to be determined by talent. But I firmly believe that a big part of it, maybe even the bigger part of it, is going to be determined by how well do we build upon the tactical groundwork, the tactical foundation that has been laid over the past 4 years.
Yeah, and to add to what you're saying too, we can talk all we want about how happy and impressed we are with the way the U.S. men played, but it's really the way Van Gaal set up that makes the statement, right? Because he set up the Dutch to play as if they were playing a peer, as if they were playing another team that could legitimately win this game and run to the knockout rounds. So that was a statement for me. And I do want to talk about the way this game shaped out. But before we do that, I want to make sure that we all generally saw similar things because the game just ended. It was emotional. So to align on the premises, what I saw was a game that was almost entirely about a single phase, which was the U.S. in progression, set in their possession against a stable Dutch defense. And the way the Dutch set up was man-to-man everywhere on the field, except that they split their forwards wide and forced the U.S. center backs into the middle. Was that the defining part of this game that the U.S. had to respond to?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and what that does is – A, primarily, it gives the U.S. a look that they have not had, I think, in all of Berhalter's tenure. There have been games when maybe a Honduras is man-marked in the midfield or Canada has been very active and stayed tight in the midfield, but I don't think anyone has really played this type of system. So it was totally new and something that this team had to figure out in 72 hours, right? So from there, I thought that the main adjustment the U.S. made, and I think overall we can agree that they didn't have it perfectly figured out, right? Louis Van Gaal did a great job, and anything we say doesn't mean Berhalter did a bad job. It was just like one genius did the perfect move on the day. But the main trait that the U.S. tried to adjust with was that they wanted to hit the pocket on the behind the Dutch forwards and wide of the center midfielders. So when they picked up their heads and they looked at the way the Dutch were defending, the first line that they wanted to break through was that Anthony Robinson and Serginho Dest had two options. You stay deep, and if they're the Dutch wingbacks come forward, then the U.S. would try and play into the channels. I thought this was almost the first two passages of the game when Walker Zimmerman and Tim Ream try and play the ball behind Daley, Bland, and Dumfries, right?
Yep.
After those first two passages, it did not happen. The Dutch wingbacks stayed back. So the next move was for the U.S. outside backs, Robinson and Dest, to slide forward and try and get the ball in the pockets behind Depay and Gakpo and wide of the Dutch center mids, which we saw often, right? Tim Ream or Walker Zimmerman would drive forward and play...
Ream to Dest in particular. Yes. And then the Dutch were sitting on that, right? Yes. As soon as Dest was receiving the ball, they were blitzing him.
And then I thought the main problem for the U.S. to not create chances was that they did not seem to have a clear plan on what happens next. You broke the first line, you got into a decent spot, then what happened? And I don't have an answer for what their ideas seemed to be, which I don't blame them for. Again, 72 hours of preparation. But did you guys see a clear idea next that came for the U.S.?
So I thought I saw Jesus Ferreira dropping off the line a little bit, but I thought his movement was slow and a little bit confused, and it didn't do anything to disorganize the Dutch back line. And so everything ended up being sort of shunted down the right side because I guess plan B, or maybe even plan A to some degree, was like, all right, get behind Daley Blind and try to bring Ake out and, you know, see if he could make combos and get to the golden zone and hit a pullback. But that never really came off. And I think tactics, you know, player quality, tactics, those are parts of it. I think fatigue was part of it too. Like there were a lot of loose and sloppy touches, especially from Musa, McKenney, Robinson, and Dest. And those were the guys who you needed to be really, really sharp and really, really good in this game.
Yeah, I do think fatigue played a big part in it. But I do think that ideas, and if you, again, we've talked about how compelling the other games were from an ideas component. I thought the ideas were really interesting in this one too. And David, what did we talk about yesterday? And what did I text you halfway through the first half that was going to be the key to the game for the U.S.?
The break, bounce, break.
Right. Which the idea is when you're getting man marked, you know, generally in Berhalter's positional play, you would take up a position in between spaces so that if you do get the ball moving forward, you can get on the half turn and you can drive forward. That is never open against a man-marking system. And I'm not sure the U.S. ever figured that out, right? They still tried to break a line, and McKenney and Adams and Pulisic and Musa seemed like they wanted to just take it themselves and drive forward as they usually would. When you play against man-marking system, you always need the second player to come underneath because it's that off-the-ball movement that creates a space and not the starting movement or the starting position. And I thought that the U.S. never got into the position where they would break the line from center back to center mid. Underneath comes the other center mid, and then they play the ball forward. And the few times they did it, it worked out. The second part I thought the U.S. missed out on was not enough movement into the depth. How often do we see when Tim Ream and Walker Zimmerman had the ball and there were seven players facing them coming toward the ball when you needed Timothy Weah to get on the last shoulder of Nathan Ake and run behind? They needed, and I know it was the plan to have Dest get into those pockets, but they really needed Dest higher to get behind the line like he did for the goal against Iran. So for me, again, Louis van Gaal did a lot right. The Dutch executed it. It was very well done by a very smart Dutch team. But those two weaknesses from the U.S. and not thinking ahead for the player underneath on bounce, break, bounce, and the runs into the depth were the ideas. But, I mean, you could also probably distill it, Doyle, down to you have to make plays and a tired team doesn't make as many plays.
I can't think of, outside of the two or three best sequences, a time when a U.S. player had a clean first touch, right? And then you add on top of that, I think just the Dutch playing in different spaces than they expected led to hesitancy everywhere. And any time anyone got the ball, especially Adams, Musa, and McKenney, with Robinson clearly in, you know, the half space on the left side, wide open, it was three touches to get there instead of two. And there was that half second that you kept losing and losing and losing outside of a few moments, or Musa dribbling out of five guys along the sideline that one time, which you were never able to build the momentum and get the right decision. Then the few times you did, I don't know that the decision-making in that final third was perfect as well. I also thought to create spaces, you had Weston McKennie go out wide. You had Adams go out wide to try and open space up. I don't think McKennie is ever a factor in the box. And this has been an issue the whole World Cup, right? He's a talented player, but he's elite at being a finisher in the box. And too much of the U.S.'s best buildup came with him as part of the triangle with Serginho Dest. And I don't know if that's him going off script to try and create, or if it's not imprinted enough over the course of video and training, saying your factor is that you are our center forward. Anytime the ball's out wide, we need you in the box. And again, this was a game where it felt like there was no out option to put in a decent cross because there was no finishers in the box. And the biggest part of that is going to go down to there's no legitimate number nine who has held that role and deserves to be on the field. But I do think with the players you had out there, it could have been different. And again, the players trying to figure out and problem solve on the fly probably didn't come to the right answer. Hence, you lose 3-1 as well. I also will throw out there, Christian Pulisic finishes that first chance. This is a different game, right? And that, and those are the stakes against Netherlands. It's even probably tougher in a round of 16 against Netherlands than it was against England. Those are the stakes. You got a free chance 3 minutes in to change the tempo, to force the Dutch to come forward, to change the game completely, and it fell to your best player. And that's probably why you're going to go home to the, from the World Cup most times for most teams, right?
Here's a quote from Greg Berhalter just now, just to throw it in there. On the attacking quality and the difference. We don't have a Memphis Depay right now who is scoring in the Champions League.
I mean,
yeah, that's a fact. That's factual. And we want, I do want to get to that concept next about the type of player Memphis Depay and the type of players on the Netherlands. But Andrew, do you want to add to that before I take it back to David's point?
No, I think it's just, I think in the high leverage moments today, you see Dumfries understanding exactly the timing and moment to make the run. You see quality of the pass, and you see him understand the angle and the pace of a cutback, and you have players that have this sort of drilled into them. This is, I'm here. This is my opportunity. I've been there before. Memphis Depay hits the ball 70 miles per hour into the exact right spot. Freaking Daily Blind.
You know, it's quality, man.
Yeah,
you can't describe it, but you sure as hell know it when you see it, man. The Dutch showed it today.
It's your right back at the back post. Like, yeah, it was a little bit of a shin finish, but you know, when he puts his hand up and he's unmarked, that's a moment. And like, that's a mistake by the US, but there's still like dominoes that have to fall. And when those opportunities were presented for the Dutch, they understood not just how to make the dominoes fall, but the technique, and it was drilled into them that that opportunity is theirs. Like, you know that cross is going to be on the money for a scoring opportunity. The U.S., man, if I would both hate and love to see a super cut of U.S. crosses, whether it be from, hell, let's make a set-piece one and let's make an open play one from this tournament. And there, it's going to be ugly watch. It's going to be tough to watch.
I mean, even the last 2 minutes of the game, Musa playing in crosses to a number of bodies. It doesn't get over any single defender. Let me just throw this out for you, and then Bobby, you take it. But someone tweeted out five different platforms, XG. They're equal in all of them, if not the Dutch by 0.1, which might be including an offside chance that was called offside late. But no matter what, that to go to what you guys just said, the chances were there for both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, let's use that to transition into a little bit of a math conversation, right? Because the XG was what, about 1.7 on for both teams, David?
Yeah, so 1.7, 1.5, 1.9.
Which is higher, if you were to model out based on how good these teams are and what they're good at, is higher than the expectation. A lot of the time when you accept that you're the weaker team, right? You're the underdog coming in. The best thing you can do is have less chances, because you would expect that the larger the sample size, the truer result, and the better the team will take more of their chances, right? So a great scenario for the US is that the XG in this game is like 0.9 to the Netherlands, 0.7 to the US, and the US happens to finish their one chance a little bit better. That is not the way this game shaped out, and that is because that's largely the way Greg Berhalter set it up. Yesterday, we had the conversation, David, that there is a macro decision Berhalter had to make about the shape of this game. Does he, A, try and make it as fast as possible so that the Dutch don't happen to show up on the day and can't hang at the pace the US are playing? That's largely what Ecuador did in their 1-1 draw with the Netherlands in the group stage. The second option is what the US men did against England, which is, can you slow the game down? Can you restrict what the opponent wants to do? And can you lull them into a false sense of security so that they give the ball away and you get to transition? And there's a strong case that when you play this Dutch team and they do Louis van Gaal's positional play and Frankie de Jong gets isolated, that they will give you a loose pass that you can transition, right? Obviously, Berhalter opted for the first option, which is to play expansive, to play with intent, as we've talked about it, to show bravery, much the way that Canada did, to try and take it to the other team. again, I think that there's a very strong reason for it. And that the way this game shaped out, the U.S. was probably the protagonist and had a lot of the better of the play.
What happened? Or did the Dutch score early and Louis van Gaal set up the way he set up?
No, the U.S. was the U.S. was stepping high in a 4-3-3 defensive shape, right? They were playing, they were defending high in the way they did in CONCACAF qualifying with the wide attackers going outside in. It was actually really interesting the way they basically turned the Netherlands three center backs into two center backs. And they somehow isolated Timber on the right. But I would say that Berhalter approached this game in an expansive protagonist way. Did anybody see something different?
No, I didn't see anything different. I thought that Van Gaal expected that. And we talked about how he expected that in how they set up defensively. But the way they set up an attack was like, okay, if the U.S. are going to be protagonists, let's bring pressure traps. And, and by that, I mean like a pressure trap is you want to hold the ball because you want to get pressed. You want to drag the defense upfield. And that's exactly how the first goal happened. It was, 15 passes around the back line, including the goalkeeper, to drag the U.S. forward. And then
starting with Frankie de Jong, by the way, taking someone 1v1 in his own box.
Right. and then, you know.
Sorry, Doyle. Sorry,
It gets to central midfield. And like, this is the play that Tyler has repeatedly been making throughout this tournament. And Depay gets away from him, takes a touch away from him. The sequence continues, and then Tyler turns his head and loses track of Depay, and Depay's off to the races up the gut, while the Dutch are off to the races up the right hand side. And like this is almost exactly what must have been on Van Gaal's whiteboard before this game. Like, you know how after the Iran game, everybody, like, I was agog, and like tactics dorks around the world were like, this is so great from Berhalter because it's exactly the type of goal that you could see the team was setting up for. I think that's what happened to the U.S. on this first goal. This was exactly the type of goal that the Dutch were setting up for. And that's why you spring a pressure trap on a front foot young team, because you want them to stretch themselves out chasing the ball. And then you trust once you have them that your guys execute. And they did.
Yeah.
Here's a quote for you. Just throwing it in there since I have a herd of elephants above my head. This is Louis van Gaal. The U.S. didn't adapt. They didn't adjust. We made our tactical plan based on targeting the flanks. What do you make of that quote?
It's the way that you should attack the U.S., right?
David, we had a conversation yesterday over text with Pamu Dakha, who we think is one of the brightest young minds in this stuff yesterday. And we were talking, do you play the 4-3-3 press or do you play the 4-4-2 restrictive block?
To be clear, I really appreciate that. It's me watching Bobby and Pa go back and forth. And I was stoked. I turned to someone I was with and I was like, this is so cool. I have nothing to add, but yes, Bobby, we were all having this debate.
Well, no, and Paul and I said, because guys, I texted everyone that that is a young coach in this country and I think has good ideas. I texted and I said, how do you set up your team against three center backs who can drop dimes from anywhere, right? What's the best approach? And really all of them said that they would do what Berhalter did, and they would step high and they would be brave and they would go for it. And Paul pointed out specifically that if you do step high, what you give away is Tim Ream 1v1 in the channel. Because if Christian Pulisic steps from the left side into the center back, and then Weston McKennie steps out to the right back, that means that Anthony Robinson has to step into a midfielder or a striker, which means that it's Memphis Depay or Cody Gakpo against Tim Ream. And that's just what you give away, right? And you have to accept when you play a good team that you're always going to pick the poison. And that's the one Berhalter picked, and Louis van Gaal saw it and it worked for them. But I'm not sure that was a bad move as much as you pick what you have to pick, and the other coach did the right thing as well.
I sent a WhatsApp to Stasekull during the game, to Sam Stasekull, our good friend who works for The Athletic, who's in Qatar right now covering all of it, and they've done an amazing job. I texted him during the game. I wanted someone to ask if Berhalter had considered setting up in a 3-5-2, especially once he knew that Sargent wasn't going to go, in order to mirror the Dutch to a certain degree, which we like mirroring. Berhalter's talked about it. He's talked about how like one of the fads in coaching these days is mirroring, as in mirroring the opposing formation. I don't know if Sam got that. I don't know if he asked it, but I'm hoping we get an answer on that, because it's something that he had to have at least considered, for all the reasons that Bobby just enumerated in breaking down how the 4-3-3 matches up against the Dutch 3-5-2.
Don't try and talk to Bobby about mirroring, because I tried to bring it up earlier in the tournament. And
Bobby, do you hate mirroring?
Conversation. I think he literally didn't hear me, but I was like, okay, cool. So I'll just sit with that one. And the one thing I will say about it, Doyle, is I ask every coach who does it, it takes you out of what you're good at. And I kind of expected him to go into it throughout the game at some point because of the way the game matched up. But once you were behind, there was no purpose, right? There was no value. And I wouldn't have been shocked if he took Jesus off, pushed Christian and Weah up higher, brought Brendan on somewhat centrally. The problem is, who do you drop into the back line then? Tyler? Like, we don't have, I would expect, like, Canada has a Tiba that they pull back as a center back, because we don't have a third center back he's going to put out there, because we don't have two that he wants to play. Right. And I think that's where you start to find the problems, where if Chris Richards is at this tournament, maybe it's a different story.
He did play. You usually dismay, but I'm just going to do the obvious. He literally played Cameron Carter-Vickers.
I understand, but is he going to play Cameron Carter-Vickers and Walker Zimmerman over name the X other players on the field?
And I will say this, it's not like the U.S. didn't have their chances. They were the protagonists, right? Like, we've established that. Like, they did have the first 20 minutes or first 10 minutes, it was all U.S. And then the Dutch go and they score on their first chance of the game. One other point, and I know that I'm bogarting this whole thing right now, I thought about midway through the first half, Tyler started dropping out of the midfield when the U.S. were in possession, dropping to split the center backs, almost the old-fashioned, like, Will Trapp used to do it for Berhalter and Columbus type of thing, and Klaassen was following him. And to me, that was the right way to approach it, because if you're getting man-marked in central midfield, well, then drop a midfielder out, switch to the three on the fly, especially when you have Jesus Ferreira as your false nine. Drop him into central midfield, so suddenly you have numbers up, and you're forcing decisions on Van Dijk and Ake and Timber. Like, do I stay on the back line or do I step? And if you could do that in conjunction with runs into the depth, which, as Bobby pointed out, did not happen, then you're eating a little bit. I was surprised we didn't see more of that specific rotation from the U.S. in possession.
And there's a moment, two moments, where Jesus Ferreira then drops all the way to midfield to help. And Van Dijk followed him both times, all the way to midfield. And you don't have a ball that challenges over the top and a runner going in. Like, that was the goal. That was the game plan. Pull Van Dijk out and attack it. And that's where it felt like the U.S. was so uncomfortable with what the Dutch did, that they then were unprepared to take advantage. Let me ask about this one, because it's literally 50% of the messages we're getting. Set pieces. Today, over the course of the tournament, what is going on with this team that hired a set piece coach that historically has been a major part of the U.S.? And I mean, all three of you have told me you'd pick X starting lineup because this player is better at set pieces. You could argue they scored one today, right? Statistically, it will go down as a set piece goal. It comes from a recycled ball still in a set piece moment. I can tell you, Bobby, Opta will put it down as a set piece goal, but that's not that real. What is going on with that, with this team?
How much of it was the runs and the design of plays, and how much was it just how many times did we beat the first man? Like, I just felt like the entire tournament, the service was pretty poor. Like, you make a great run, but if the ball's not there, if you're not forcing defenders into difficult decisions or goalkeepers to consider whether they're coming out or punching or whatever it is, like, you know, no offense to Christian, but also the service I thought was poor.
Yeah. Yeah, the service is bad. I mean,
I don't think that was the case in this game, by the way. There was multiple balls that were hit into the six or over everyone, and there was not a single person there.
I would love to know.
I don't know that Zimmerman beat his man one time.
Yeah, I would love to know if somebody saw something. Because, of course, you hire a set piece coach, you expect it to be more than you start in a block and you go near middle far.
Yeah,
I did not see much more than that. If somebody did, I would love for you to get in the comments and tell it to us, because I did not see it throughout the tournament. We only saw one non-whipped ball into the box, and that one opportunity was almost a great chance, except it was an underplayed pass. So I don't know why there wasn't more outside of the box options, but I think it's a great point, David. If you are the U.S., if you're going to advance, you do need set piece goals. And I don't have a great answer as to why we didn't see more variety in it.
This is a competitive advantage, or possible competitive advantage, that just became a moot point throughout the entire tournament. Mm-hmm. It's really disappointing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's everyone's answer for the thing they've been yelling at me about and asking questions about. We talked a bit about Pulisic's miss. We talked about Adam's sort of the mistakes. What did you see from halftime on? Gio Reyna comes on for the U.S. What did you make of the adjustments made by this team and sort of the rest, the way the rest of this game played out?
I have a lot of thoughts on what could have been better. I'll be really interested to see how the other top teams in the turn or the top teams in the tournament do against this man marking system, to see if it was a scenario of the U.S. was unprepared for it and should have done better, or if it's just who can really prepare for this singular system in a 72-hour window. Because the inability for the U.S. to work in tandem and work together and solve that, for me, was a big question. And the reason I say that is, come the second half when Gio Reyna came on, I did not get the sense that there was a new idea that was added into it as much as there's nothing else. Like, we can't add a new system into play here. We can't add a new pattern. We clearly over 72 hours could not integrate the right fixes. So let's just get the most talented 1v1 player we have on the bench onto the field and hope that in this series of 1v1 duels that they can ultimately outplay their opponent. So did you guys see anything that changed beyond just really a man for man switch for a player more conducive to those 1v1s?
It was just tactics free zone, you know, like as the game got closer to the end, it just became more and more anarchy. And like, this is American football heritage right there, man. Like that's the only real switch. And I can't even argue it was the wrong one, because I thought the U.S. were a hell of a lot of fun and put the Dutch under a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. I think if Gio Reyna was fully healthy, it might've looked different. But he I don't think he sprinted once in the second half. He wasn't able to take
He ran that ball down that almost went out, and probably for any other player, they pick it up 10 yards before the sideline.
Yeah.
He had to gut it to the end.
And he wasn't able to beat anybody off. He didn't look like Gio Reyna and everything. You know, it sucks because he was healthy up until three days before the kickoff against Wales. And if he's healthy, I think, you know, that second half looks different. I think the way we play in the group stage in the second half looks different. But no, there was nothing to it except just bringing on a different guy. And the hope is that 4 years from now, there'll be more answers and that the guys that we do have will be, because of experience, will be cleverer about figuring stuff out, like what the Dutch threw at.
Yeah.
Or we'll just be healthy. Just have the benefit of timing.
Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, we got to get Gio out of Dortmund, because how many players, if they at like they've shredded the hamstrings of so many of their players.
Yeah, I do want to come back to your point about fatigue, Matt, because I think blessedly this finally adds a little real insight to the whole conversation about age. And I know Weeby brought it up at the beginning, and I know that it's a good storyline and I know that people engage with it. But if I hear one more time about how young this team is, if it means a damn thing, like my head is going to explode.
How did you not see that play out today? I don't understand.
We did.
I totally disagree with that.
This is what I'm getting to. I thought today it played out, right? In an actual soccer way. In the fact that really what you talk about age is you talk about two things, right? You talk about predictability, you know, just like emotional consistency. That given the situation, given the moment, you know what you're going to get. And two, you have mental fitness, mental endurance. And I thought the story of today was about a group of guys who worked extremely hard and did just about everything right for 270 minutes. And it wasn't about the physical component. It was just that if you lose focus for 1 second, you get punished. And they really hadn't lost focus for 290 minutes or so. And then they did. And that's what it was. So I thought today was the first real example. And maybe this is just me being upset with the lack of real conversation from some of the main outlets about it and why age matters, except that it's sexy. But today was the first moment when we actually saw how age plays a role in performance.
But okay, whatever.
I don't know if I agree with that level.
So you didn't notice it over the last three games, but if they had played the way a lot of young players do play, you would have noticed it because they'd be out of the tournament.
And then there's a macro point where it's like, oh, it's really exciting that 9 of the 11 starters from today could and maybe even will be on the 2026 team.
And not like geezers.
Yeah.
Not like dragged around the pitch because they have to be there because there's nobody else. Or again, to go to the excitement of the youth, is that These guys might be 27, and 27 might be too old. They might get pushed out by the next generation.
Yeah, I would be shocked if five or six of these players start a 2026 World Cup game. Like, I would genuinely be surprised. That would be my baseline. If you were asking to place bets, I'd say 5.5 would be the line, because I do think the future players are as good or if not better. Plus, now you probably are going to continue to win dual national conversations because the team seems fun to play in, has reset themselves on the world stage. It's not a black hole of soccer to go into. For a lot of guys, it's going to be a better opportunity to play. Either way, besides that mental fatigue, what do we make of the way the roster was managed, selected, and used? Because you talk about subs and what could change. At halftime, is Gio healthy? Because otherwise, there's not a single other option on the team. Is that on Berhalter? Is that the reality of the pool?
That's on Berhalter. I think the biggest knock on Berhalter is the central midfield subs that he brought. Kellen Acosta deserves to be there as a backup for Tyler Adams, and that's it. Like, he's not a number eight at the international level. Neither is Christian Roldan. Neither is Brendan Aaronson. Both those guys are wingers at the international level in this system. Same with Gio Reyna. And then that leaves Luca De La Torre as the only number eight. And he got hurt 2 weeks before the tournament and clearly either was not fit or was not trusted enough to play. So there was no chance to take Musa out. And Musa's not a 90-minute player at this point in his career. He just has never shown that level of fitness. So there was never a chance to take Musa out in the group stage and replace him like for like. And that frustrates me, because there were opportunities to integrate the likes of Pomacall, Eric Williamson, Keaton Parks into this group earlier this year or earlier this cycle, and Berhalter never did it. So my biggest gripe with him is that, like, I think he misidentifies some central midfield talent, and I think that put the U.S. in a position where they had to ride Musa to the point where, like, he came out and he was so leggy he couldn't trap the ball, and McKennie, you know, he's been hurt all tournament, was only 60 minutes fit. That frustrates me. And then the other one is, I get the Jesus Ferreira thing because it works so well on paper. But thinking about what this team could have looked like with Brandon Vasquez or Ricardo Pepi, it's not the difference in terms of how they play today, but I think it would have helped, right? And the sport is about creating 5% difference here, 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 and here, and adding, you know, hopefully stacking all of that. And so, like, I think Berhalter got 85% of all that stuff right, but that 15% that he didn't, I'm not going to say it cost them today, because it's other stuff that cost them today, but it made today's job harder.
Can you say more on the center midfielders? Why do you not have Aaronson and Reyna as center midfielder options?
Because Reyna doesn't win the ball and doesn't really defend at all, no matter where he plays on the field. And Aaronson, he presses forward every time. He treats 30-70s like 50-50s, and you have to have the right structure behind him to make sure that doesn't work against you, because if you're losing one of your central midfielders 70% of the time he goes off to press, then the other guys are going to have to get into panic rotations and scramble. That's not how Weston McKennie plays a position. That's not how the Yunus Musa plays the position. That's not how De La Torre, when he's fit, plays the position. It is how Pomacall, Parks, and Eric Williamson play the position. And I think it made so much sense to just bring more like-for-like options, specifically to make sure that Musa and McKennie were at least 70 minutes fit in this game. Neither was.
You know, your point to the roster selection. Can I add something, David?
Yeah.
Your point to the roster selection, Doy, which I thought was really interesting, and I'm not sure I expected it from Berhalter, is I remember when we had first started to talk about Greg together, it was about 2018. And the opening of the show, we did the previews on the Columbus Crew, was system, 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 right? You can put any 11 players in there of a certain quality, and the Greg Berhalter system will get more out of it, and you can generally trust that the level that they will get to. I expected something largely similar with this national team, right? Overall, it was a very clear, it was a pretty coherent system. But what he never did is he actually never opted for and please correct me if I'm missing a moment here, but he effectively always opted for the highest level player in each situation. He never prioritized the system over the player. And I know there was a conversation about
You're saying through qualifying or at this World Cup?
I would say both.
I think people who are fans of John Anthony Brooks and Tim Ream and Jordy Pefock would disagree.
Okay. Tim Ream's an interesting one because I think there's a huge sample size about his performance in CONCACAF.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that's what people are going to be tweeting at us and yelling.
That's what I was looking for. I think you're right. I think John Anthony Brooks might be the best example here, right? It's clear that like Berhalter just doesn't rate John Anthony Brooks as high as he rates at Walker Zimmerman
world followed that because he has not played 1 minute in the last year of soccer. But that would be
I think I appreciate you pointing that out. So John Anthony Brooks is the opposite. But we have talked, I don't know if it was on the shows or privately, and I had said to really anybody to listen that I think that this team performs better with the way Berhalter wants them to play through the progression and create chances with the ball and disorganize the opponent and all of that, to that it would be better if they did not have Weston McKennie in center midfield. If they did not have Christian Pulisic playing the role that he had, or if Pulisic was coming off the bench. And throughout all of it, Berhalter opted to keep really what his players were playing at the highest level on the field at all times. And I thought come the World Cup, you could see why it was. Because regardless of the way the game shaped out, Weston McKennie could play at that level. Yunus Musah could play at that level. Christian Pulisic could play at that level. And I'm not sure I expected that coming in, but it provides light into the lineup decisions that he made, right? Why do you bring Luca De La Torre? Because every day he's training at a La Liga level. And if you have to put him in against England or the Netherlands, regardless of the way the game looks, you can generally expect how he would play. So do I agree with it? I don't know, but at least it creates for the most part, intellectual consistency that you can point to it and understand why it happened.
To be fair, Luca only trains at La Liga level.
For sure. For sure. I'm not taking away from that. But, you know, except for John Anthony Brooks, I'm not sure I can think of an example of where that's not true. Maybe the center back position.
Pefock is the one, I think.
Pefock's been terrible for 2 months. Like he had a good
Jesus
August.
Ferreira hasn't played for 2 months, Doyle.
He also didn't get called against Japan, Saudi Arabia. I think that's where it stands out, right? When he was scoring, he doesn't get called up. Because he's like bottom percentile in touches, passes. He literally is not involved in the game except for when he scores goals for Union. Let's ask the question here that everyone started this thing out with. Who is the next coach of the U.S. men's national team? Is it Greg Berhalter? Is it not? What's the process look like? Weeby, start us.
I think Doyle made a good point. It's what I've been thinking about for a while, and that I think this tournament, just as much, if not more than so for his players, as far as a stage to show what you can do and what your qualities were, that is what this was for Greg Berhalter. And he's not said this to me explicitly. I've had a number of 1v1 conversations with him. Yeah. So to be clear, he has not said this, but my feeling is that he would like to be a club coach, and that he's a guy that wants to work day to day, and he's all about, as Bobby said, system, and implementing ideas and having a project that builds and progresses. And I think it's hard to do at the national team level. And I think that while this job is going to be super attractive because of the 2026 aspect of it, because of the historic, you know, like weight that it will have, there will also be a ton of weight, and that weight won't come with built-in competitive games through qualifying for the next coach. So it's going to be a little bit of a limbo cycle unless U.S. soccer is truly able to go out, and they should be, to be clear, they should be able to do this. They should do this to get into something like Copa America. Hell, let's do Copa America scenario again. Let's just say we're bringing it over here. Like we're going to pour money into your coffers, South America, but we're going to do it selfishly, both for ourselves to have a dry run as far as the World Cup goes, but also to put our team in the position to be at their very, very best. I think he did more than enough for a team in Europe to look at him and say, this could be a good option for us. He's got experience in a number of different countries. I think he has that ambition, and the door only cracks for American coaches every once in a while. So when it cracks, you better be ready to jam your foot through. Mm-hmm. If he gets that opportunity, I think I personally believe that he will take it. That's just where I stand.
Yeah. It feels, can I actually parse the question back for you and Matt, David, into two parts? Does Greg Berhalter want to be coaching this team in 6 months? And does U.S. soccer want Berhalter to be coaching this team in 6 months? Are they the same answer? And how does it feel for each of them?
So my biggest fear is that both don't know, and they just end up stumbling along which is sort of what happened with Bob in 2010, right? It was like, we don't know who's next. And Bob didn't know what was next. And he continues on. I don't believe in keeping the same coach for another cycle. I would add, I have a different take on what Wiebe just said, which the lack of qualifiers, the lack of competition. This is a unique opportunity to go to coaches who have specific systems and styles and say, this is the one time you have no stakes for 4 years and can implement it. Because I believe what happened for Greg was it came down to results at some point because he had to get to the World Cup. And like, obviously the big one will be Jesse. If you go to Jesse and say, yeah, it's going to take a while to build a cohesive pressing unit with an international team. And guess what? We've got 4 years. You don't have to qualify for the World Cup. We don't care about Gold Cups. We don't care about Nations League. Here's your one opportunity to coach a national team where you have time to build the thing you want to build. And I think besides being a host country, that is the other unique nature of this U.S. job for the next 4 years, that you can pitch to coaches around the world. That takes me completely away from your question, which is, I also don't think Greg wants to do this anymore. I think Greg likes soccer too much. I think he's tired of watching players play for their club teams all year and going and talking to coaches and directors. I think he wants to be on the field day in and day out. And I think you see that in some of his frustration with, there was a lack of respect for the results. There's a lack of respect for him, I think. But I also think that comes with, he's not 100% enjoying what he thought he would. And so you see sort of a little bit of a disconnect. And so I agree that I think he wants to be a club coach. I don't know who was making decisions at U.S. Soccer, so I can't speak to what I think they want.
Shouldn't it be Ernie and Brian?
Should be. Does that mean Jim Curtin's getting the job? Give me Jim Curtin.
I don't know.
Doyle, your turn.
That's all I have to contribute. No, I suspect, look, you guys aren't the only ones I hear it from that Berhalter misses being a club coach. And from what I've heard myself, he has created a lot, like a very nice network for himself over the past 10 years or 5 years while coaching the U.S. team, and obviously has something of a network left over from his playing days as well. I think he's going to get an offer in Europe, and I think if he does, he will take it.
Where?
I don't.
At what level?
I don't know, Wiebe.
I'm just we're speculating. This is straight speculating. So it's just the thought experiment. Like, what do you think would be a logical level or destination?
If here, I'll put it on the. If he gets a Heerenveen job, does he leave for the Heerenveen job?
I mean, Groningen needs a new manager right now.
Okay,
they have an American center forward.
Would you personally leave for the Groningen job?
No, but look, it's a doorway into European coaching, and that is arguably the final frontier for American coaches. Mm-hmm. And you know, with very few exceptions, Jesse Marsh, Pellegrino, Matarazzo,
and Greg Berhalter, by the way, right?
And Greg Berhalter, right? Because he did have Hammarby, right? That was the decade.
Here's
ago.
The other thing: he doesn't have to take a job. There's no job that's like, hey, it's January, you got to take a job. Like, he can be, I think he can be patient to a certain degree. Like, because U.S. soccer, there will, and I agree with you, Dave, there will be a level of urgency. I think there is more attractiveness to this job for certain coaches. I just personally don't think that Berhalter wants to sit around and do that. And I don't know if repeating the process is necessarily what is attractive to him with this team. So he could wait till the summer. He could wait till the coach is fired in, you know, May. He could sit around and wait and see what happens.
Yeah. So I just, in my mind, the way I would think about it is, if you get offered the Barcelona job, you take it. If you get offered the Hammarby job again, you probably don't take it. So where in between is the threshold, right? Is it a Groningen Heerenveen? Is it a Union Berlin? Is it a Hoffenheim? Is it a Crystal Palace? Like, where, and I'm curious for people out there to think about themselves, what is the right job for you to leave the U.S. men's national team ahead of the 2026 World Cup?
Which I will say the U.S. Federation is saying, come back.
My favorite landing spot would be a Hanover or a Hamburg, like one of the traditional Bundesliga teams that has been mired in mediocrity in the second Bundesliga. And like,
when Doyle has a glass of Jameson tonight, it's going to be with Berhalter coaching at Hanover and signing Pomichael, Miles Robinson, and Brandon Vazquez in the first window. And then
I mean, that would be a really good window for them. I'm not sure they have the money.
It would be a Jurgen Klinsmann-esque window. Just sign everyone you secretly like and then see what happens after.
Yeah. I would love to ask a question here on how you guys, because I think context is really important to this. And for Berhalter's performances, you have to, we have to set a premise for what the player pool is right now. So where is the player pool and what tier are they in the world? And I'll say, you know, generally speaking, they're not in the top 10, right? If it's the 9 favorites plus Colombia in terms of just how good the 20 players you can pick for a men's World Cup are, can you help me think about what the, what tier the US is in so that we can then evaluate Berhalter performances on that? So, you know, we'll say the 10 favorites plus the next tier is Uruguay, Denmark, and Croatia. You know, is the US in that? Is it below that with Switzerland, Serbia, Ecuador? You know, how do you guys think about this? Because I think agreeing on this foundation is really important to thinking about how Berhalter is done and what should be expected of the team now and moving forward.
I think it's 15 to 20 in the world. And I think a lot of people have been very convenient saying, oh, well, look at the clubs, but it's also the playing time, right? And when you talk about Croatia and Denmark and Colombia, sort of, but Colombia, I think, is a bit of a mess right now. You're talking about players who, okay, they're at Fiorentina, Sampdoria, Sevilla, things like that. They're also starters. There are few players in this U.S. team that start week in and week out for their club, right? Timothy Weah is not a locked-in starter at Lille, and he doesn't have a position. Christian Pulisic doesn't start for his team. Weston McKennie is not a full-time starter for Juventus.
Yunus Musa is not a striker for his team full-time.
Yunus Musa and Tyler Adams are probably... And Jedi are probably the only ones, right? Dest doesn't start. He doesn't really have a club right now. He's at Milan on loan from Barca. So that's the difference in that gap is, like, when you look at Denmark, all of their players start for the clubs they play for that are in the starting team. They have their own issue, which is, I think they all have the same skill set in their club teams, and therefore no one brings the other stuff to their national team. But that's where the US, I think, sits behind the rest of these player pools, is not in that high-end club name or the ability. It is, no one is relied on week in and week out for their clubs. And so I think you saw it today. Even, like, there were two or three moments where Tyler Adams and I think Yunus Musa did what they've done all tournament, whether it was Adams just trying to win an easy ball off someone or Musa trying to turn someone. And Cody Gakpo won both those battles because he's bigger and faster and stronger than the other people they've done that against over the course of this World Cup. So I think it's pretty clear if we say, what, Iran and who? Ghana and South Korea are 20 and back, that this is the 15 to 20 range that I think the U.S. sits in. Am I the only one?
No, I completely agree. I completely agree.
So that 15 to 20 range, I think the other countries in that are, again, just above it would be Croatia, Denmark, Uruguay, probably Belgium now. And then
you have to throw Italy in somewhere as well.
Well, Italy's in the 10. Yeah, sorry. Italy, I guess the 11. It's the 9. I guess probably Italy takes Belgium's spot. So Italy, Colombia are 9, 10. Croatia, Uruguay, Denmark are the next group. And then you try and figure out, where does the U.S. fit in that with Morocco, Switzerland, Serbia, Japan,
Mexico,
Ecuador, Mexico, Peru, Norway, Poland. Like, it feels right that the U.S. player pool is probably somewhere in the middle of that, depending on who's healthy on each group, could be at the top or the bottom of that tier.
And the excitement about the age, which you are less excited about, is if now these players all step up and become starters, even if it's not at Chelsea, right? Like, if Pulisic becomes a full-time starter wherever he ends up at a high level, now the young guys who are pushing for minutes on their club teams can push for minutes on this team and don't have to be relied on, where the game has to run through you, right? The moment you get on the field for the national team for Yunus Musa at 18, the game has to run through you for 90 minutes. And if you make mistakes or cannot play at that level, now you get the Landon Donovan, DeMarcus Beasley effect, which is, when Landon played in 02, he was a winger who could attack guys and play free because Claudio Reyna and John O'Brien and Pablo Mascherini and Brian McBride, they were going to handle the battles. They were going to take a lot of the load off you. They were the ones who were going to take the ball at their foot when the game was against you. We don't have that right now. And that's the hope, is that this pool grows faster than a Poland or a Colombia or whatever is capable of, because there has been a change in this country where those countries are kind of running along the same model and just hoping a special player pops out here and there.
Well, and there's more of a path. This goes back to what I was saying about the youth, Bobby, is like, it might not even be this generation that we just saw, this core that we're saying, hey, you need to go find that perfect club spot. But they've opened the door for the next generation to find that club spot, to get a club to take a chance on them, to make them a starter, to not have it be a scandal that Americans are in that position. And I think there's also just some, like, some experience and some learnings from a lot of these players and many before that of, like, where is the right place to be? What is the right path to take? Like, because a lot of this comes down to being at the right club at the right time and making the right choices in your career to be in a position to be an important player and a starter in that moment, mm-hmm. to develop in a way that when you're 23, 24, you get there. I don't think we've had that experience. Maybe that's with our players, our agents, our coaches, our GMs, probably across the board. Like, we just haven't exported players and had that success. The players, the countries that we're talking about in 1 through 15 have. Mm-hmm. So
not totally. Poland, not all of them. Colombia, it's new. Ecuador, okay. It's new.
Sure, but sure, yeah. Sure.
But they're fitting into a model.
There is much more of a historical precedent there for them, and there's much more of a connection and a legitimacy based on previous players.
We got to do like an hour show about the Poland economy, GDP, the growth.
Are we really considering Poland to be a better, a more talented team than the U.S.?
I don't think so. No, not Poland. Like, maybe the top tier, the top tier four.
I would disagree with both of you. I understand the hope and excitement around the U.S., but I disagree that literally just Zelensky. Who is better than Zelensky?
No, I said, you give. So Lewandowski is as well. I'm giving you those players.
Well, all the center backs. I don't agree with either. But it doesn't matter. We're splitting hairs there.
But I think it does matter. Sorry, I think it actually really does matter. And Matt, I really want to hear your opinion on this because I know that you fight as hard for American players as anyone, and there's no right answer to this. But I truly think one problem with the Berhalter conversation is that the group of people, there's a section of people who see Pulisic at Chelsea and the players at Leeds and McKennie at Juventus. And they're like, we're a powerhouse, right? Why are we not beating Wales 4-0? Why are we not beating that? And like, I just think it's really important as a group to agree on premises moving forward. And I know that we can't get to an exact number here, but nobody else has had this conversation. Like, how good are our players? Right? What is the baseline here? So I'll take literally anybody that provides worthwhile insight is of value here.
I think it's a bigger discussion. I think right now we're a third tier team who needs everything to go right in order to beat a first tier team. We had that against England. The only thing that didn't go right was Weston didn't finish his chance. In this game, we were facing a second tier team and they were more surgical and we didn't have anything go right in terms of our fitness and form from our most crucial pieces, which was compounded by losing our starting center forward to injury before the game. If Sargent had been out there, I think maybe things would have looked a little bit different, but this level of the game, the margins are pretty slim. And I think round of 16, by definition, you're one of the 16 best teams in the world. That feels about right.
Yeah.
And the hope will be that 4 years from now, it's top eight and maybe even top four. And the difference between the U.S. and Poland, the Netherlands, Colombia, mm-hmm. is that so much of this group is not even in their primes yet. And so there's very rational reasons to hope that, or to even expect that they will be much better 4 years from now.
Yeah. I understand what you did there about the top 16 teams, but that's not really true, right? You still wouldn't take the US or Australia over a 5-game series against Germany, but
no, I wouldn't, but I genuinely think that the US are one of the 16 best teams in the world on talent. Sure. And
so just to contextualize that.
You would take the U.S. over Australia, which drops right,
and I would take them over Korea, and I would take them over Poland, and I would take them over Japan, and I would take them over a bunch of other teams.
You're coming straight to the heart with the Japan take right there, Bobby. Can I ask a question?
I think it's fair, but I do think that is your personal instinct on the U.S. And I think the best assessment of this player pool is that it is in the same tier as Japan, Switzerland, Serbia, Morocco, Norway, Poland, Ecuador, Mexico. And on any given day, that matchup is 55-45, and whoever plays better on the day wins, less so than because of the pool of talent. So yeah. I understand Doyle saying that the U.S. should be right behind the Uruguay, Belgium, Croatia tier. I'm disagreeing and saying that they are firmly in the next bucket. So that when we do watch, and I think it was just disrespectful and objectively, like it was journalistically wrong for anybody to pretend like we should have beaten Germany or done better, maybe done better, but like, or Japan, excuse me, in that friendly, like Japan is the U.S. on quality. And it seems really important that we contextualize that. So that's my piece on this.
So now moving on from that, we talked about Greg Berhalter. We talked about his future, what he could do, what he should do. Let's say he leaves. What is the thought process on who you would like to see replace him or what you expect? And then after that, we'll talk about what are the next few years look like for the U.S. Men's national team.
Sorry, David, you hate when I do this, but I want to go back to the last point. Because I think that, well, I think in terms of the player pool, and this is going to get mad energized again, because I want to make one final point, right, about where we stand on the player pool. And the way I think about it, I think the way most people think about it, is that there's basically three components to development and creating a player pool that can compete at the top level, right? Three inflection points. The first is effectively the 0 to 12 age, right? We'll call that the grassroots. The second is something like 12 to 15, which is about elite intentional training. And the final is the pro player development, right? Does that resonates? That makes sense for the most part, right? Like, what do you do with your friends on the playground to age 11 or 12? What do coaches and real training and methodology give you from 11 to 15? And then what does professional training, and to a point that Matt brings up often, professional opportunity, right? If you play at age 17, you're way ahead of anybody that plays at age 19. Those are three main parts of the pathway. The U.S. undoubtedly for 10 years has improved the middle function, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars have gone in to improving players from 12 to 16 at academies all over the country, right? In the last 4 years, Major League Soccer has greatly improved the third part, right? If you look at the number of minutes to domestic U22 players, it's spiking, right? And a lot of that honestly probably goes to the hashtags that you guys have started. The final point goes to the first one, right? And this to me is how does this get solved, right? How do you improve the grassroots so that 8-year-olds in the country are doing the same thing that Croatians and Belgians and Uruguayans are? And I don't have a good answer to that. So I wanted to get that part in. When you talk about player pools and you talk about what separates them, I do think the main part before, the main like separation now, is that first 0 to 12 grassroots effort.
Yeah. The part of the answer is today. Right. Part of the answer is having all those kids watch a soccer game and be like, oh, yeah, I can go out in the right. I watched Jason Kidd and then went in the backyard and put up shots, like maybe not shots. Maybe I was
trying to say, you were throwing passes. Yeah.
You bounce past against the wall.
Yeah. So I think that's a major part of it. And that's one of those things where as more players play, there's going to be more example of that. Also to what we started us with, if you have the example of the pros that kids want to become, and that's the only path and the only reason you should play the sport, but there's no doubt that that's what inspires a lot of people. Can we go back to my question, Bobby, or do you have a six?
Oh, that's great. Sorry. I'm great. Thank you. Okay. I appreciate the space for that.
So can you guys give me some sort of early idea about if Greg Berhalter leaves, who you'd like to see replace? And Doyle, you brought up Ernie Stewart and Brian McBride. What do you think the process looks like?
I just assume it'll be a global search if and when it happens. If it's someone from MLS, you have to assume that Jim Curtin would be the favorite, given his connection to Ernie Stewart, given that his team before Ernst Tanner arrived used to play a lot like Greg Berhalter's Columbus Crew team. But like back in the day, 2018 or so, the Union were very similar to the Crew. Pellegrino Matarazzo is probably going to get a call. One would hope that they expand the net pretty significantly beyond that, including to folks that I'm not even thinking of to mention right now. I hope Hugo Perez gets a call, whether or not it's likely that he gets the job. The way that El Salvador team played during qualifying, his commitment to building up young players, which is still going to be necessary, and his lifelong connection to U.S. soccer, those all argue that he should at least get a sit down. But who knows? Maybe it'll still be Greg.
No, you didn't put Tata in there?
I did not put Tata in there. Though actually, like, Tata weirdly might be a good coach for this group, because it's not going to be about integrating a new generation. It's going to be about getting the most out of guys who are already in good spots. And like, look, this Mexican team, they were not very... We don't need to talk about Tata. He's not going to get the job, so we don't need to talk about Tata.
I just did a Doyle thing.
Yeah.
I just wish Anders was here with the Frank de Boer worst manager in the history of the Premier League, just to toss that one.
Yeah.
Wait, do you have names? Do you have
thoughts? I don't have names. I mean, I think Berhalter is the most obvious one within MLS. You know, I think if Chirundolo's career had started at the club level a little bit earlier than just this year, you might look at him as a guy that could be getting looks here. But I hope it is. I hope it is international. I mean, obviously, it needs to be. And that they're turning over every rock and, you know, finding somebody who has the personality to connect to these players, but also has sort of the ability to take them to the next level as far as just the tactics and preparation goes. I mean, I don't have any specific names for you. I have no idea what they want to do. And I don't know.
None of us think that Jesse Marsh would leave Leeds United to take over the U.S. national team, right?
No. No, but the thing about being a manager in the Premier League at a team that's, you know, hovering where they will hover in the table most likely is that you don't always have it's not always your choice.
It's not always your choice, yeah.
Correct. So
yeah. I do want to add one last part about the players and everything. Is that okay?
I'm listening. I'm like, I got a 5-year old here. I'm like, all right. So
here's
what are
the
these
thing. Can I just let everyone know? Me and Bobby have been having this conversation in text for 7.5 years. So I'm less excited, but Bobby, I would love for you to continue.
I'm not trying to make overarching sweeping statements. I'm trying to parse out a conversation that I don't think is had often or ever. I do think that there is a distinction about what we saw from the Dutch players today. And one of the main conversations we've had throughout the tournament, David, is this inflection point. And it's the inflection point as a macro men's program overall that the United States, I think, has been in for 5 years. And I would actually probably say it was navigating this inflection point that led to the bad results and the bad luck in 2018. It's what Denmark is going through. It's what Uruguay is going through. And it is, how do you go from being someone that can, you know, beat anybody in the world occasionally to anyone that can truly control a game and win as the protagonist, right? And I do think that that requires a certain type of player. And that even if we have players now that can compete and get us to the, you know, the type of performances we saw, it's still a different type of player with a different makeup and profile than we saw from the Dutch team, than we see from the Croatians, than we see from some of the other countries, which is you can have the same level and quality, but the makeup of that quality determines the way the game shapes out, which is just about comfort, about fluidity. So I will be interested to see how that gets adapted into the U.S. coaching courses, into the U.S. youth levels. And I'm sure they're already trying, but I thought that was a clear difference. And if you even were to say that Tyler Adams is the same quality overall as Frankie de Jong, which I think I've heard at some point in this show's last few days, that the way Frankie de Jong plays is more conducive to these types of games.
But he didn't play like Frankie de Jong today. He actually played like a sane human being. He didn't do all the Frankie de Jong crap that makes him terrible for Barcelona.
Although he did on the goal.
That's fair. He did on the goal.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that that's something to keep an eye on, that even if players are playing at a high level, even if they have wonderful ability, what is the profile of that ability? Because I've just firmly believe, and I think that this is generally made out throughout, you know, through every evidence, you know, it's just the way the world works, is that passing and comfort are everything. And that we're still like, that's the next part of this. So in terms of what's next, right? How can we continue to become a culture that is built around passing and comfort? Because as wonderful as transitions and pace and energy and all of these things are, it still comes down to that comfort to control a game and that comfort in tight moments. So that's what I'll be keeping an eye on with the player pool. And, you know, Weston and Tyler and Musa and these guys are still young and what it does for them. So that would be the bet or my instinct moving forward.
Get in my chat, man. Start texting me. I know Dave doesn't want to hear about it, but I got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And come on, baby, we want to see Weeby on the back of a USMNT jersey someday. So you give me some, tell me what the tape on the garage door. slash what drills to do at home. I'm here for it. Just
they're going to be sitting behind 2026 Golden Ball and Ballon d'Or winner Jack McGlynn for quite a while. But good luck.
Jack McGlynn is that type of player. He is the player I'm talking about.
Dusty's from Middle Village, baby. Shout out Queens. Let's finish with one thing. Rich Kaufman would love for all of you to finish, and you all have to finish on one thing you care about or want to see for the USMNT from now heading into 2026.
I'll use that conversation as a transition to this. That I would love to see us have an elite facilitator come through, right? Somebody who can really control a game through their comfort and tight spaces, their reading of the rhythm of the game, of the tempo, right? Frankie de Jong, Verratti is that player. I had this little Pedri is that, like, there's all these types of players that for everything we produce, we still don't have that. It was probably Darlington Nagbe over the last generation. But I would love to see that type of player come through.
Okay. Doyle, Weeby.
Thrash it. You're shaking your head. You can thrash it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
No, I agree with that. I just can't believe you think Frankie de Jong is that type of player. It's insane to me. Like by 2026, before 2026, Yunus Musa will be so clear of Frankie de Jong. It's ridiculous. I want to see an elite center back. I want to see someone who can play like Tim Ream in possession with the ball, but is not a liability in the air. Tim Ream was great this tournament. Mm-hmm. I think you could argue a little bit with his body shape on the second goal, but like he was superb. But against the best teams in the world, he takes a lot off the table in terms of what you can do defensively. So my hope, and look, I honestly think that over the past 10 years, center back has become the hardest position in the game. It's no longer demon. So I want to see, whether it's Chris Richards or Miles Robinson finds another level, or, man, I don't even know who else, like Brandon Craig or Fakranis, the kid from the Galaxy. Like,
name ex Notre Dame alum who we don't know about yet.
Right. Exactly. You know, like I want to see us develop that. That's the big thing.
Weeby?
Yeah, I took myself off mute intelligently because I think we got a training session going on above my head right now. I hope they're playing defeat. I'm going to keep it sort of macro and big picture in terms of the trend that we see already in Major League Soccer, because that's what we can control. We can't control how other soccer cultures, leagues, clubs, coaches perceive us. I want to see steady upticks in the percentage of minutes that that players in their teenage years play in this league. And I think that the congestion of the schedule and the way that Leagues Cup is coming, and I think Garth Lagerwey said it to me on Extra Time the other day, that it's going to force that given the way that rosters are constructed. I want to see more opportunities given to those players. And I think as we've seen over the last 5 years or so, the more opportunities those players get, the more you start to see that they're ready or can handle those opportunities. We need that to happen to then make the jumps to the leagues, to the places, to the environments in Europe, that at tournaments like this put players on a platform to thrive at a younger age. So, you know, seeing Paxton Aaronson make a jump, seeing what Brendan's done, et cetera. Like, we need the numbers game to increase way more. We need a lot more dice throws. And that comes from playing players in a professional environment and challenge them at a young level. So, or an early age. So I want to see more teenagers playing in MLS as much as possible.
All right. I think that works for us. Let's get out of here. We are not done for the World Cup. We are here every single day, 5 p.m. Eastern time, which will be right off the back of every single round of 16, last match, quarterfinal, semifinal, and then we'll obviously move the time up a bit for the final. Every single day there are games. We are here reacting to what you saw, putting it into context. We've got some great categories. We celebrated the group stage yesterday, best moments, best young players, everything we've seen so far. So we're going to keep having fun and keep enjoying this tournament. This is only the first game of the round of 16. So it feels like we've lived a lifetime in about 4.5 hours already, but we still have a ton to go. So I'm going to appreciate all of you.
I'm going to go have a beer and watch a game for the first time this tournament.
I know. It's going to be fun. Argentina against Australia.
Are we doing another show tonight at 5 p.m. after that game? No, this is it for today.
We are done. We are done for today. I think the 5 hours we just did is probably enough for everyone to sort of hang out.
I feel like Bobby might have more player pool questions after that game.
Oh, don't worry. It'll come. USNYT chat that you've all have forced me into that I couldn't mute fast enough or whatever new WhatsApp group Bobby and Elliot and you create off the back of this one. So I have to listen to it all again. No, but it is really exciting. And by the way, if some of what we said, names didn't trigger for you, you don't understand the concepts, you find it interesting. We cover a lot of this day in and day out. I go down to the youth championships every year. We talk about youth development. We talk to academy directors, technical directors, coaches. This is a lot of what we do. What Bobby said before is hashtag play your kids. We all push it over and over again. And now we got to see some of them play at the World Cup, and we're hoping to see more continue to come up. So thank you to three of you for joining me, especially Weeby and Doyle, who just came off a 6-hour show or whatever they did already. Thank you to Bobby Warshaw for always being there. Thank you to Rich Kaufman. The biggest thank you, of course, goes out to the father of the year, Rich Hernandez, who takes a few moments every day away from his precious kids, the family he loves so deeply, to be with us. We really appreciate him.
Thanks.
And we
appreciate. Thanks as well to Wyatt and Cameron for providing the rhythm section.
For keeping it quiet. Yeah. For keeping it quiet.
And to Liz, my babysitter today, who has made all this possible.
MVP from Liz. And thank you most of all to all of you out there for listening. We appreciate you. In the words of Hans Bakke, you're never going to beat the Netherlands in 2022, but 2026 is our year, baby. With that, we are out, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.